ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if living offline isn't a choice anymore? I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm finding out just how much of our lives are online and whether we can ever really unplug. From privacy experts to hackers, we explore what it means to disappear in a world that's always watching. Opt Out. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Natasha Mitchell here with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas Summer Edition. It's Christmas. Hope you have a merry one or a peaceful one. Holidays might mean that you are getting out into wild spaces, or maybe you're more of a couch traveller and you love an animal doco. You love entering that intimate world of other animals with the help of legends like David Attenborough. One day you might be off to the wild Serengeti to hang with hyenas, or Antarctica to watch penguins preening, or maybe a tropical forest to meet some mountain gorillas. Look, nature documentaries are fabulous, no denying it, but are they kind of deceptive? Are you even being manipulated? Yes, it feels like a gift, doesn't it, to get up close and personal with the animals portrayed in natural history films. And so much of what we understand of the natural world is shaped by the screen, by films, by photographs. Did you know, though, that many of the scenes are staged in studios with, get this, captive animal actors? Does that matter? Does this idolised representation of wilderness have serious consequences? It's an issue former banker and author turned passionate eco-tourist and environmentalist Satyajit Das takes up in his book Wild Quests, Journeys into Ecotourism and the Future for Animals. We're joining him at the Australian National Maritime Museum today.
In Life on Earth, David Attenborough filmed mountain gorillas in Rwanda. He reclines in the grass very close to an adult female. Suddenly she stretches out a hand and touches him. Surprised, Attenborough seems to speak spontaneously. There is more meaning and mutual understanding in exchanging a glance with a gorilla than any other animal I know. That iconic moment is memorable, but entirely misleading. The gorilla was habituated to humans, being part of a family being studied by Diane Fossey. We also have no idea what the other primate thought of the encounter. Still in moving pictures, shape our relationship with the wild. Images of animals in wild places deceive us into thinking that we know wilderness. Do we? For humans, nature is a commodity to be killed, domesticated, tamed, or exploited. Wildlife films and photos are just another part of that tradition. They have more to do with the viewer than the viewed. The portrayals pretend to enter into the realm of these creatures, but only within a human frame of reference. This is patronizing. It is deeply sentimental. It implies a deep disrespect. It also reveals our troubled relationship with the natural world. As Leo Tolstoy wrote in his novella Haji Murad, "What a cruel and destructive creature man is. How many different living creatures and plants he has destroyed in order to support his own life." Nature documentaries have a long, complex history, driven mainly by commercial considerations. Luc Jacquet's 2005 Oscar-winning March of the Penguins grossed over $150 million. Hundreds of millions tune into BBC blockbuster series such as Our Planet. Wildlife channels such as Discovery, National Geographic, Animal Planet, BBC Earth all have substantial subscriber bases. Documentaries, definitionally, speak to facts. But wildlife filmmakers originally sought to accurately portray the natural world. But technical considerations, audience demands, and business necessities forced them to focus on entertainment. Technical limitations meant that the early efforts were filmed in zoos. The Monkey's Feast, made in 1896, showed two monkeys eating bananas. The animals were actually pets. People assumed that animal behavior in captivity was the same as in the wild. Hunting films were popular. The 1910 Return from Africa documented the US President Theodore Teddy Roosevelt's year-long expedition, which netted a staggering 40,000 taxidermy specimens. Roosevelt believed in conserving by killing. Audience liked the bloodlust, the drama of stalking, capturing, or killing animals. The films were always presented as factual, but scenes of charging lions, elephants, and rhinos were frequently staged. There was even a dedicated facility in Los Angeles to film these sequences. Naturalists, naturally, objected to the fakery. After World War I, Germany became leaders in scientific wildlife film productions. They mainly featured small animals and were shot in a studio due to the lack of money. During the Weimar Republic, they focused on the combat for survival. During the Nazis, they conveyed ideological and racist propaganda. Ants and bees were very popular subjects, conveying social efficiency, discipline, and sacrifice for the common good. After World War II, entertainment values began to mold wildlife filmmaking. European filmmakers such as Armand Denis and the director of the Frankfurt Zoo, Bernard Grzmek, pioneered films such as The Serengeti Must Not Die. Walt Disney produced the True Life Adventure series. The Living Desert showed the lives of desert animals in southwestern United States. The Vanishing Prairie explored America's disappearing grasslands. Profitable wildlife documentaries helped finance Disney's expensive animated features like Bambi. Disneyfication meant pretty landscapes and anthropomorphized animals. Cringeworthy voiceovers spouted cliches about natural harmony, the arc of life and death. Cute music underscored the action. Violent and gruesome truths were taboo. Wildlife documentaries were very suited to television and its regime of weekly shows. In 1954, the BBC started airing ZooQuest, introducing a young TV presenter, David Attenborough. While producing and presenting The Pattern of Animals, a three-part program on nature, he accidentally met Jack Lester, the curator of the Reptile House at London Zoo. Attenborough and a young Czech photographer, Charles Lagus, were invited to accompany Lester to Sierra Leone to capture snakes and a white-necked rockfowl for the zoo's collection. Attenborough took over as presenter when Lester fell ill and ultimately died from a tropical disease. The show enjoyed a successful 10-year run. The formula was extremely simple. Attenborough joined London Zoo staff on expeditions. The focus was on collecting specific animals. The format allowed for coverage of other wildlife, local people, local customs. Another figure to emerge in the 1950s was Jacques Cousteau, a former French naval officer and inventor of the aqualung. In partnership with the French New Wave film director Louis Malle, Cousteau released Le Monde du Silence, The Silent World, featuring ravishing underwater cinematography. Subsequently, Cousteau would create two television series, The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau and The Cousteau Odyssey. The market for wildlife films really expanded with the arrival of the blockbuster series, Kenneth Clark's Civilization and Jacob Bronowski's The Ascent of Man, both designed and produced by David Attenborough. They were smash hits. The same approach underpinned the path-breaking Life on Earth, A Natural History. The 13 55-minute episodes featured Attenborough traveling the globe to explain the evolution of life on the planet. It would inspire many, many journeys, including ours. The programs revolutionized wildlife documentaries. They featured rarely seen animals and events. In each episode, Attenborough outlined an overarching thesis about a species or behavior that the footage explored. Life on Earth paved the way for subsequent series, which would be based around animals, the life of mammals, the life of birds, or specific habitats, the Blue Planet, which was about oceans, and Life in the Freezer, which was about the polar regions. Attenborough became a globally recognized figure and one of the most trusted people on the planet. Wildlife documentaries have broad general appeal. After all, there is little to dislike about nature and animals, especially if presented in their sanitized form. They're considered educational. They enjoy civic and religious support, being consistent with traditional Christian doctrine espousing humanity's preeminence and the exclusion of animals from divine grace. The emphasis on family and parenting was ideal. Religious conservatives in the United States praised March of the Penguins because it portrayed monogamous emperor penguins as upholders of traditional family values. The stoic and hardy birds were also hailed as proof of intelligent design, the belief system that rejects Darwin's theory of evolution. Nature programs also appeal to our more primal instincts. We are still animals, after all. In an episode of Friends entitled The One with Sharks, Monica mistakenly believes that her husband, Chandler, is sexually excited by shark documentaries. Advertisers found that natural history documentaries could reliably deliver large audiences. The initial focus was on selling pet products, tourism packages, travel equipment, and cameras. It expanded to building public awareness and soliciting funds for environmental causes and animal charities. The power of cute and cuddly creatures to sell goods and services should not be underestimated. Advertising and sponsorship were relatively cheap. Wildlife shows cost less to produce than a typical sitcom, in part because the stars were unpaid and not represented by a union. Advertising and sponsorship dictated the content. The story should have a happy ending. The forces of good must prevail. One of filmmakers Alan Root's documentaries was rejected by the sponsor Kraft. The family-oriented company's food products, such as cheese and crackers, were thought to be incompatible with shots of hippos defecating and hornbills smearing mud and excrement to seal their nests. Today, many advertisers and sponsors are reluctant to explicitly reference climate change. Nature tends to stillness. Animals spend much of their time feeding or resting. True wildlife watching is long periods of inactivity with occasional bursts of action. Documentaries, in contrast, require constant movement and drama to satisfy the audience's short and shrinking attention span. This forces the use of literary and dramatic archetypes familiar to viewers. Documentaries are made to a predetermined storyline that is not actually driven by the animal's behaviors that are observable or the actual footage shot. Scripts use standard tropes. There is the quest, a difficult journey in pursuit of a goal with characters overcoming obstacles. The filmmaker may be searching for a species. Quests lend themselves to symbolism and moral questions about survival, life, death. Other options include a young animal's growth into adulthood, an adult's migratory journey or mission to find a mate. Another standard formula follows the seasons, the filmic equivalent of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, allowing the filmmaker to explore wildlife in a specific place. The story must engage audiences emotionally and intellectually. David Attenborough's first ZooQuest trip was to West Africa in search of a bird that few had ever seen alive. Picathartes gymnocephalus, the white-necked rock fowl, a crow-like bird with a yellow bald head and a skull cap like a black patch. In his autobiography, Attenborough describes being accosted on the street.
Dive, are you going to catch that Picathartes gymnobloodycephalus, or aren't you?
The audience had clearly embraced the show. Animals in wildlife films are frequently humanized with Kipling-esque names. They conform to stereotypes. Primates are human-like. Lions, regal. Elephants, funny. Jackals, sneaky. Orcas, vicious. Beluga whales, friendly. Snakes have never recovered from their bad press over the whole Garden of Eden episode. Animals must display human emotions. Playfulness, fear, sadness, anger, heroism. The result? Soporific melodramas. Available footage may not fit the storyline. In Yellowstone, we visited a photographer who was monitoring a nearby winter den for a film project about bears bringing up their young. I asked how he could be certain that there was a female with cubs inside. He confessed that he wasn't. I asked what would happen if he was wrong. He drawled, "Guess they'll make someone up." Wildlife documentaries are actually created largely in studios. This requires high shooting ratios, that is, the total footage shot relative to what appears in the final version. Blue Planet 2 necessitated 125 visits to 39 countries over 4 years to capture over 6,000 hours of footage for 7 60-minute episodes. Planet Earth 2 is understood to have required 2,000 days of filming by 40 camera operators in around 200 locations. Huge amount of time is then spent in the studio compiling the feature from the material shot round an artificial narrative. In reality, wildlife documentaries bear little spatial or temporal relationship to true wildlife. Finding and following the same individual over long periods is nearly impossible, especially in the polar regions or oceans. Where the viewer is told there is one animal, it may actually be composite footage of several animals filmed separately in different locations. One film purporting to follow a female leopard has her descending a tree. Close inspection reveals that she has prominent testicles. It seems she is a he, a la Lou Reed's famous song, "Walk on the Wild Side." Getting the required footage isn't easy. During our stay at Madagascar's Kirindi Reserve, a crew were filming the island's wildlife. They had closed off part of the reserve to film mating fossas, a mammalian carnivore unique to Madagascar. Typically, a receptive female occupies a suitable tree and males visit, bringing food. much like humans. The filmmakers had identified such a tree. A camera hide was built high off the ground at great expense, the scaffold having to be transported in by helicopter. In the finished documentary, which we saw later, we could not find any footage of fossils at the mating tree. Perhaps the animals did not use the tree, or the film crew were unable to get suitable shots. One workaround is to use stock footage. In Yellowstone's Lamar Valley, on several occasions we saw an award-winning filmmaker videoing animal behaviors or landscapes for use in future projects as needed. Shots of running animals usually entails chasing them in cars. The famous pink clouds of flamingos taking to the air over Kenya's Rift Valley are provoked usually by a low-flying plane or a drone. Chum, an oily mixture of fish and blood, is used to attract sharks when filming. Bird calls are routinely used to attract birds to be filmed. In Gorillas in the Mist, there is a scene in which a silverback charges at Diane Fossey. In his biography, filmmaker Alan Root recalls that Rwandan gorillas, accustomed to humans, ignored all provocations and flatly refused to charge. He joked that they were sitting around reminiscing about the time they met David Attenborough. The actual footage was of Mushamuka, a gorilla Jade, my partner, and I would later see in Congo. A guy told us that he had spent hours provoking the silverback in order to stage the scene. A documentary on Borneo records a small Yoda-like Tarsier's reaction to an approaching python. Our local guide had been hired by the filmmakers to catch the snake and place it near the primate to elicit the response sought by the filmmaker. A well-known sequence of polar bears giving birth was shot in a Belgian zoo. Footage of a wolf suckling newborn pups used captive animals in a specially constructed set. A bear feeding on a carcass will usually be a captive animal searching for hidden jelly beans in the entrails of a deliberately slaughtered deer. Filmmakers wanting to film snakes hunting prey like rats routinely use captive specimens placed in close proximity to the prey on a set. Ramon, our guide in the Venezuelan Llanos, told us that in order to create an anaconda mating ball, one filmmaker placed an assortment of males with one female in a large oil drum overnight. He then dumped the snakes at a suitable spot to film footage of what appeared to be a writhing mass of bodies trying to mate. Some of the animals used in wildlife films are captives. They're kept in appalling conditions. Desired responses are elicited using electric cattle prods or piano wire tied around their necks. Sometimes wild animals are trapped and filmed in a specially created set. At least these animals are typically released back in the wild.
For passionate ecotourist and author of Wild Quests, Journeys into Ecotourism and the Future for Animals, Satyajit Das, wildlife documentaries are animal melodramas. And that's a problem. So why do reputable filmmakers play along? Natasha Mitchell here, bringing you ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. It's our live event show, and we're with Satyajit Das at the Australian National Maritime Museum.
The justification is the scientific merit of recording behaviours that cannot be easily filmed in the wild. David Attenborough admitted to arranging scorpions to mate in a studio, complete with a painted sunset and styrofoam cloud. It would have taken months in the Mojave Desert to try to record this event under natural conditions, and there was no guarantee of success. Capturing sound contemporaneously with the action is entirely impractical, particularly since these days things are shot with huge telephoto lenses at distances of several thousand meters. For close-ups of a bear or a tiger walking in a stream, the noise that you hear is from a sound library. Alternatively, it can be created in a studio, for example, by the engineer splashing his hand in a basin of water. Opening and closing an umbrella mimics the sound of a large bird's beating wings. Biting a celery stick approximates a predator tearing into flesh. Wildlife documentaries claim realism, but the final product is entirely manufactured. Filmmakers say they're after the true story. At least the story part is accurate. Ecotourism is increasingly oriented around photography. Expensive cameras are mandatory accessories. In theory, photographs can play an important role in education, promoting interest in the conservation of wildlife. In practice, there are examples of consumption. Sanitized hunting, where the lens replaces the gun. It is another example of the commoditization of the natural world for human purposes. Professional photographers seek out arresting images, but they're not always what they seem. The prestigious annual Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition started in 1964. It attracted a mere 600 entries. Today, it attracts tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of entries. Famous artists compete alongside aspiring amateurs. In 2009, the winner was controversially stripped of his prize. His picture of an Iberian wolf leaping a cattle pen was allegedly staged using a captive animal. An animal behavior specialist noticed the photo. Foxes do not jump over fences. They go through them. In 2018, a prize-winning photo of a giant anteater near a termite mound against a starlit night sky was disqualified. The animal in the photo was suspected of being a taxidermy specimen. But the bulk of photographers are hobbyists, some looking to share their journeys with family and friends. But with the advent of social media, more and more ecotourists now see themselves as content generators. They frequently ignore ethical standards and animal welfare in their quest for the right viral photo or video to impress their followers and increase subscribers. Most are entirely oblivious to any damage to wilderness. On one trip labeled a photographic expedition, we calculated the aggregate cost of the passengers' cameras, lens, and paraphernalia. It would have run into tens of millions of dollars. Several National Geographic photojournalists were on board, running workshops, providing personal tuition to the paying customers. Most tourists seemed absorbed by technical details. Brands, bodies, lens, doublers, image stabilizers, tripods, and editing software. The actual place, which happened to be Baja California, the scenery, the wildlife, which was exquisite, seemed completely irrelevant. Except as an image in their viewfinders. Patience and skill are no longer mandatory. Playback of bird calls allows photographers to get the subject into a well-lit spot and exhaust it so it is still for the perfect shot. In a point and hope numbers game, technology focuses the camera automatically. Rapid multiple shutter releases increases the chance of taking one random good picture. In Iceland, a visitor told us that he had taken 6,000 photos of a single minke whale that day. In Australia, a photographer fired off 1,000 shots of a flying black-chested buzzard in a few seconds. Evenings are spent staring at a computer screen, deleting blurry or truncated images. A deficit of technical expertise is no longer a handicap to getting a good photo. It's not even unknown for the guide to actually take the photo for the client. A kind of intermediated art. Wildlife photography encourages reliance on hides and feeding stations. Some are even equipped with special chairs fitted with a discreet pot for the photographers to relieve themselves to avoid missing that once-in-a-lifetime photo opportunity that might just present itself at an inopportune moment. All photographers fantasize about the perfect photo. A tangible and lasting image of the moment that can be physically or digitally possessed. In the case of amateurs, this most commonly entails mimicry. Professional photographer Thomas Mangelson's best-known photo is Catch of the Day. It captures the moment a spanning sockeye salmon flies dramatically towards the waiting jaws of a grizzly bear. Shot in 1988 on film, before digital editing even existed, the photographer Mangelson confessed that taking that one single shot took him months of perseverance. Fellow professional Tom Walker's famous photograph is a study of a nesting red-throated loon. The bird is a soft grey-brown. The throat and eyes are subtly different shades of red. The grass stems in the background are a subtle gold. The loon sits on the nest, its head slightly raised, perfectly reflected on the still surface of the pond. Walker, ill with a flu-like sickness, waited for days in terrible weather amidst clouds of mosquitoes trying to get this photo. It was taken around 2 a.m. in the morning. The wind died down very, very briefly. The sun shone for an instant. The photo captures the fleeting moment the bird raised its head to look at a nearby Arctic fox. It is magic incarnate. In 2009, Japanese wildlife photographer Toshiji Fukada photographed a wild Amur or Siberian tiger. It is one of only a handful of images of this species that exist that aren't taken with remote camera traps. There are only perhaps 300 of these animals left on the earth and less than 12 in Russia's Lozovsky Nature Reserve on the shore of the Sea of Japan, which is where the photograph was taken. Fukuda spent months in a hide overlooking a beach where sika deer feed on seaweed near the shore. On day 50, he was awoken by the alarm calls of ravens. There was a tigress less than 150 meters away. In the soft light of a clear morning, the orange and black of the animal contrasts with the white snow. The tigress has her head slightly raised and looks directly at the camera. It was the only time he ever saw the animal. A casual ecotourist or wildlife photographer is unlikely to capture such original images. At Brooks Falls, where Mangelson's shot was taken, people are rotated through short stays of about 20 minutes on a viewing platform with limited space overlooking the waterfall. They push and shove one another in their determination to reproduce the catch of the day. Individuals have the right to spend their money and time pursuing the perfect experience. but it cannot be at the cost of the subject. A key driver of wildlife photographs is purely commercial, selling binoculars, telescopes, and cameras. The global market for binoculars and cameras in 2023 was around $16 billion. Makers sponsor fated photographers to promote their equipment. In the circular economy, wildlife photos feed interest in photographing animals, which in turn creates new images, restarting the cycle. The only real winners are the sellers of the equipment. In any case, expensive technology is a deception. As French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson noted, photos are not made with the camera, but with the eye, the head, and the heart. Guardian columnist George Monbiot took great offense at David Attenborough. He chastised Attenborough for betraying the natural world. His films misrepresented the existence of vast tracts of pristine wilderness and abundant wildlife, fostering the impression that cultivated complacency and inaction. The accusation is not fair. Some filming practices are questionable, yes, but documentary filmmakers such as Attenborough and photographers are not responsible for destroying or saving the natural world. The self-deprecating Attenborough thinks of himself actually as a filmmaker. But he admits that he's a convincing image of what people assume a naturalist should be and a naturalist should look like. For the most part, their work has helped people gain a better appreciation of wildlife, seeing things that they would not generally see in real life. In a small village in the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia, we watched a program showing tarsiers hunting insects with locals. All this shot in a reserve just next door. The villagers had never seen that behavior directly. But media depictions also create insidious expectations of what tourists can see in the wild and encourage them to pursue unrealistic experiences. Manipulated images can mislead in other ways. They lull us into a false sense of security at a time when the natural world faces a series of ecological catastrophes, with habitats and animals disappearing rapidly. Wildlife documentaries that seek to inspire an appreciation of the natural world may perversely hide the unpleasant truth. It halts us from taking action to ensure their continued survival. Realistic shows that present the effects of climate change and species loss draw criticism for being depressing. Documentaries cannot inspire concern in unreceptive audiences. They cannot engage those seeking an escape from reality into superficial optimism. Audiences, it seems, do not want to be confronted by the true state of the nature and endure the fear and guilt that it may provoke. In Chile's Torres del Paine National Park, we watch a female puma and her playing cubs. A National Geographic cameraman is filming nearby. Suddenly, the film crew's minder approaches us, telling us we must leave. The cameraman wants a panning shot showing the animals against the vast, empty spaces of Patagonia. Having us in the footage would detract from the notion of pristine wilderness that the filmmaker desperately wants to present. In 2003, the Wildlife Photographer of the Year award went to German photographer Gerhard Schultz. The winning photo is of a gorilla and child in Miami's Metropolitan Zoo. Two primates sit lost in thought. The gorilla is seated in his enclosure behind glass. A reflection shows the child admiring the primate to whom he is closely related in the chain of evolution. The gorilla has a resigned expression. He's a prisoner far from home. His species, once abundant, is near extinction. There is no place in this world for him and his kind. The only existence that is afforded this magnificent giant is as an object of curiosity. The pioneering American conservationist Aldo Leopold thought the notion that the wild community is one thing, the human community another, is false. True conservation requires a state of harmony between humans and the earth. Civilization has been hammered out of the raw material that is wilderness. It is enslavement of a constant and stable planet. It is a denial of a state of mutual and interdependent cooperation between humans, other animals, plants, and soils, which can be disrupted at any time by a failure of any of them. Leopold wrote, "Wild things were taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free." Few, if any, true wild places and wild creatures are left. All that remains is isolated populations and areas that survive because of human vanity and capricious choices. No matter how ravishing the images of wild animals and untouched wilderness that we see today, a little more than memento mori, Latin for remember that you must die. They testify to the natural world's transience. They bear witness to its destruction at our hands. Each is an elegy speaking to what is disappearing. It also anticipates another end. Our remarkable intelligence is currently on track to produce the extinction of humans, which is how evolution rids the earth of failed adaptations. 99% of species ever to have existed on this planet are now extinct. There is nothing, nothing, nothing special or permanent about us.
Thank you so much.
Author of Wild Quests, Journeys into Ecotourism and the Future for Animals, Satyajit Das, here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's the idealised wilderness, the manipulated photography. What is really going on behind the camera in wildlife docos? And what's being hidden about the real threats to the species whose stories they tell? Satyajit Das is now taking audience questions, and he starts by explaining how he, a former banker, became an environmentalist.
I got interested accidentally when my partner and I went on a holiday, and the first thing I ever saw, I was brought up in Calcutta. The only wild things you see are cows, crows and rats. And so I'd never seen wild animals at all. But by a quirk of accident, we ended up in Africa and saw gorillas in the mountains of Congo. You can't go there now. And that was my first experience of wildlife. And then by another accident, we ended up in the Antarctic in 1994, which is before going to the Antarctic was a thing. And by a strange process, I was hooked. And for better or for worse, our travels coincided with the whole growth of ecotourism. Because remember, we're going back now 35 years. At that stage, nobody ever did this. A few people did this. So I got to see the entire development of the industry. And I'm naturally curious. So I learned a lot about it. And I kept learning more about it and gradually getting more and more alarmed.
I mean, we think now about the scariness of AI and what are we looking at? Is it true? Is it not true? Is it fake? And to sort of see that this sort of thing has been happening in the past is quite scary. Like, when did you suddenly realise that what we were seeing was fake or staged or...?
Well, I knew how filmmakers worked, and if you travel in remote parts of the world, you inevitably come across film crews. And they're bored because they're going to spend 7 or 8 months of their life sitting there waiting for take 30 seconds of film. So you get to talk to them and you ask them questions and they tell you how the whole thing is done and you start to understand what it's done. I can actually tell you which bit of the film in some of the films comes from where and which camera took it, because a lot of it's just historical footage. Because I'll give you an example. There's one very famous scene of electric eels killing a caiman, which is an alligator, because a young alligator mistakenly went straight into the electric eels, and the electric eels pack a massive electrical charge, and they just throw themselves on the body of the alligator and electrocute it. It's like an electric chair. There's only one piece of footage, because the cameraman who took it, I don't know him, but I know somebody who knows him, says he was actually there to film something entirely different. And he looked there and thought, oh my God, what's going on there? And he took that. And it's very bad, grainy film because it's very old, but there's like probably about 45 seconds of film. And everything on the Amazon will try to get that and splice it in.
It's not a question, but it's interesting timing when the museum has the Wildlife Photographer of the Year exhibition on.
That's why we
chose yes.
It. Yeah.
And it did make me think, however, whether it's real or contrived or whatever happens to make that film, you have to hope that people, or many people, will still get the message about supporting organisations that try to protect wild animals. And I know the one at the zoo with the one on Borneo with the palm oil area. So we have to hope that regardless, that at least the message does get across.
Hope is the operative word. I have not seen much signs that, and Attenborough said this, he said he'd hoped that these beautiful images and beautiful animals would inspire people to change behaviour. But unfortunately, I can't see a lot of that actually happening.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. Firstly, David Attenborough in his later films was very conscious of climate change and did push it. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. And the second thing, not all photographers, and I've been on wildlife expeditions where I got so sick of people citing how many are on their list and they're going to get more on their list. And I have seen some admirable retirees who've done a lot for preserving nature in our urban environment purely because they take wonderful photos very unselfishly and really show what we have and the need to protect it. So I'm just wanting to counter that not all photographers are out there, you know.
You think she protested too much?
Yeah.
Are you a photographer?
No, I'm not. Okay. I wish I was, but I know people that
Let me answer that question at two levels. I have no problems with people taking photographs as long as it doesn't start to change the behaviour of the animals and basically does not interfere with them. But 90% of the photographers that I now encounter are so desperate to get a photo record of what they've seen. They're starting to manipulate things. Like, for instance, I'll give you a very good example, nest sites. There are certain birds you can't see outside of nest sites. That doesn't mean we haven't visited nest sites, but we've never done it where in any shape or form we think there's any threat to the thing. And the closest we ever get to nests are like 50, 100 meters away. We never ever get closer than that. But the photographers aren't basically satisfied with that. There is an Australian bird called the square-tailed kite, and there are no nesting sites. And a guide who we know, who's very, very ethical, mentioned this to somebody who's a photographer, a professional one. Next day he went there and the guy's there with scaffolding, building a scaffolding right next to the nest because looking up, he doesn't want to shoot up, he wants to shoot down. So what I'm saying is it's fine if you occupy your time doing that in ethical ways, but the edge, and I've seen that with people who start off very ethically, they get more and more into this and then, and to a large extent, it's got nothing to do with the photographs or the subject. It's a competition among themselves. It's just they're a small group of people and it's like how big my appendage is, basically. And so essentially that's what they're doing. And that is very, very dangerous. And there's a very famous case in South America where there's a very rare bird. It's a small tapaculu, which are skulking birds, incredibly difficult to see. And this one was particularly difficult to see. And the tour company which took them had photographers who were also desperate to see them. They surrounded the bird and actually trod on it and crushed it. So what I'm saying is, yes, there are ethical people, but my experience, which goes over 30 years, is not necessarily consistent with that. All of them follow that, and most of them. And now people deliberately advertise things where we will have hides, we will feed the bird, we will do this, we will do that to attract that. And the major thing here is money. The people you're talking about with that, their camera gear costs several hundred thousand dollars. They think nothing of paying, you know, $100,000 to go and photograph a single bird or a single animal. And that's the problem.
Thank you for telling the truth. I think that...
Nobody's ever thanked me for that.
Yeah. I have a question for you in terms of you're showing the manipulation of the financial and the capitalistic society we live in. In terms of climate change and manipulation, a lot of people think it's a hoax, some people think it's real. And there was a king, King Number 9 from Thailand, his name was King Bhumibol. And he was
the last king.
And he studied in America, you know, he was a jazz musician and he was quite well educated. And he came back to Thailand and he saw his people that were kind of starving and he said to them, plant seeds and I will make it rain. And he cloud seeded in the 1960s, I believe. And he made it rain for the whole nation. And they loved him. That's what a real king does. He provides for his people. In terms of that, if they can make it rain, is there manipulation perhaps? I'm just asking a question. I'm not stating the fact.
As I understand your question, is there anything we can do? The answer is that everything we're doing now for climate change or anything else is at the margins. We're not really addressing the core issue. The core issue is pretty straightforward. There are 8 billion people on the planet. The planet can support a certain amount of people in a sustainable fashion. Today, we are the 8 billion people on Earth are basically require 1.7 Earths worth of resources. Today. And only 10% of that population lives at a living standard that everybody in this room pretty much takes for granted. So if the other part, the other 90%, attain the living standards, which we have, and which they aspire to do because they see it projected into their lounge rooms or their villages every day of the week, then we're going to need 3 to 4 Earths. And the last time I looked, we have one. Okay, Elon Musk notwithstanding. He's probably creating another 3 Earths at the moment in between his other activities. But the point I'm making is that if you have such a large population overstraining resources, there's only 2 ways of doing it. One is you've got to bring the population levels down to sustainable levels, or there's another option is which you adjust living standards. But adjusting living standards is something that we cannot countenance because we've been programmed pretty much and propagandized to assume that living standards will constantly go up. And that's the core of the challenge. And we can dance around that in any number of ways. Let's put it this way, sorting your waste into 3 bins is not going to save the planet.
Satyajit Das, he's a former banker turned environmentalist and eco-tourist. Lucky him, what a gig. His latest book is called Wild Quests, Journeys into Eco-Tourism and the Future for Animals, which examines the ways we use and abuse the images of wild animals and how they shape our relationship with animals. Hey, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Great to have you on the show each day. Find and follow Big Ideas, our podcast on the ABC Listen app and outside of Australia, wherever you find your podcasts. I'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.